Again, for those of you who've just joined us, welcome to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the SPRC Training Institute. At this moment, 625 people are connected to this webinar. I'm delighted to report that over 1,100 people registered to attend this event, and those people hail from 48 U.S. states, as well as several locations in Canada, Guam, and Puerto Rico. Again, I'd like to welcome you. Now, on to our presentation. Today, we're fortunate enough to have Effie Malley, Caitlin Ryan, and Dave Reynolds with us. First, we'll hear from Effie, who is director of the National Center for the Prevention of Youth Suicide at the American Association of Suicidology. She previously worked at SPRC, where she co-authored a white paper entitled Suicide Risk and Prevention for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Youth, and she served as lead developer of a workshop kit for staff in schools, youth-serving organizations, and suicide prevention programs entitled Suicide Prevention Among LGBT Youth, a Workshop for Professionals Who Serve Youth. She'll briefly describe these resources and the practice implications of modifiable risk and protective factors. Tiffany, if you could please unmute Effie's line, we'll get started with the presentation.
Schools, church. Oops, I'll start over. Welcome, everyone. I want to thank you all for the work you do, caring for our youth in the many ways the participants today reflect. I saw settings like schools, churches, military, health, mental health, LGBT organizations, higher ed, and others. I'm standing in my office in the midst of a raging blizzard, but it's just great to think of people all over the world that really reflect global interest in preventing suicide among lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth. To introduce myself, my name is Effie Malley, and as Gail said, I'm currently developing a new center for youth suicide prevention at the American Association of Suicidology, which is the oldest national organization for suicide prevention, a membership organization of 40 plus years leadership. I gave the SPRC workshop that I'm going to just preview for you today probably a dozen times to maybe nearly 500 people. I'm indebted to them for their feedback because it really helped to shape the workshop. There's a little lag with the advance here. Today, I'd like to first give you a quick overview of the SPRC workshop kit. The kit has everything you'll need to deliver the training to your agency or the group that you serve. Secondly, I'd like to give you a brief introduction to using risk and protective factors for LGBT youth with slides from the kit. There seems to be quite a lag. I'm not sure if that's just the way it is.
Effie, we're also happy to advance the slides from this end, too, if there's something happening. So just let us know.
Okay. Thanks, Gail.
Sure.
The workshop kit is available online on the SPRC website. The objectives you see here are for the full four-hour workshop. The workshop reviews terminology, research findings, risk and protective factors. It also recommends a cultural competence approach and gives some basics about suicide prevention. The workshop is designed to be adapted depending on your time limitations, your audience, and your purposes. Yeah, I think I better have you advance them because I hit the button and then it doesn't advance for a while.
No problem.
Great. The kit includes a PowerPoint presentation with leader notes for each slide. You get PowerPoint slides, not a PDF file, so you can make changes to the presentation. The Youth Voices PowerPoint has quotes reflecting both positive and negative experiences from LGBT youth. The Leader's Guide will instruct you about preparing and giving the workshop, and the handouts are also in Word, so you can adapt them. You might want to add slides and/or handouts about local resources, or add new research or additional information on a particular topic. Next slide. A major point of the workshop is to speak about LGBT youth suicidal behavior accurately and appropriately. To do so, it's important that you understand the limitations of the research. Data on suicide are limited by the fact that sexual orientation usually isn't included in cause of death reports or on death certificates. Another way we gather data about suicide is through psych autopsies, that is, exploration of factors leading to the death by interviews with people close to the deceased. Yet LGBT individuals may not have disclosed their sexual orientation or gender identity to the people close to them. Looking at other suicidal behavior, most hospital data on suicide attempts does not include sexual orientation or gender identity. Suicide ideation and suicide attempt data are largely based on self-reports. In surveys in which people self-report suicidal behavior, they may be asked to report their sexual orientation. However, respondents may not identify with the terms used. For example, youth who consider themselves gay might not choose the term homosexual, or youth who have had sex with other youth of the same sex might not consider themselves gay or bisexual. There are also a number of issues related to research methods. Many studies use convenience sampling to find subjects, and these results can't be generalized. Or they may only be able to study a small number of people, which again can't be generalized. It also precludes looking at the data from different demographic groups, such as race or ethnicity. Longitudinal studies are needed to show risk and protective factors, how they function over time. Next slide. So to talk about suicidal behavior accurately, suicidal behavior includes first, ideation, that is talking or thinking about suicide, second, suicide attempts, and third, suicide deaths. This slide is a summary slide that shows higher rates of both suicide ideation and attempted suicide among LGBT youth. You may have questions. For example, where are the transgender youth? The majority of research focuses on lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth. Some studies about transgender suicidal behavior have adult subjects or small samples or convenience samples. Some of you may be wondering why the range in results. There are several reasons. Some studies use different time periods. Surveys may ask about behavior over the past month or year or lifetime. The research might look at different populations. They might be looking at male versus female, different regions of the country, cultural groups, and different aged youth. And researchers may ask the question differently. For example, consider the questions that researchers use to find out about sexual orientation. Researchers can ask about behavior. Did youth ever have sex with someone of the same sex? Or they can ask about attraction, whether the youth are attracted to the same or opposite sex. Or researchers can ask how youth identify themselves as straight or heterosexual, bisexual, or as gay or lesbian or homosexual. And the researchers would get different results depending on how they ask the question. Next slide. Now to review the findings about suicides among LGBT youth. Two early studies did not find a higher rate of suicide for LGBT youth. However, both studies have been challenged as possibly inaccurate. A third study, the KIN study, analyzed sociodemographic data for people who died by suicide and found homosexuals had a higher risk for dying by suicide. However, the KIN research did not apply specifically to youth. None of these studies included individuals who are transgender as part of their research, and little information is available about transgender youth suicide deaths. So, although LGB youth have higher rates of suicide ideation and attempts, we cannot conclude that their suicide rate is higher. I want to make one comment here that you may often see quoted, a federal Health and Human Services study by Gibson that found homosexual youth represented one-third of youth suicides, and also found that suicide was the leading cause of death for LGBT youth. However, this study was not sound and should not be used. Next slide. Now I'm going to switch gears to introduce the topic of working with risk and protective factors. Many of the slides you'll see are from the workshop kit, and I added a few others. Risk factors make suicidal behavior more likely, while protective factors less likely. Just to be clear, a risk factor could be a cause of suicide. On the other hand, it could be a contributing factor or just a statistical correlation. A risk factor is established through research for a specific group. For example, a survey of white youth in Minnesota identifies risk and protective factors that may not be applicable to inner city minority youth. Suicide is a complex behavior and there's no formula to predict it. For example, protective factors may not eliminate risk factors. Also, risk factors are synergistic, meaning that the effect of a single factor is increased when an individual has additional risk factors. Risk factors are not simply additive. Next slide. To start, there are two broad approaches for using risk and protective factors: working with individuals at risk and targeting groups at risk. Today, we're going to focus on the second approach. Risk factors are a key component in planning an intervention to target at-risk groups. Many program staff want to identify the problem as quickly as possible, then move immediately to an intervention. But I want to encourage you to spend some time defining the problem and discussing contributing factors. One way to do this is to work with a group and use a planning process. Next slide. This is just one model for strategic planning. Many of you work in settings where you could put a group together to talk about the problem of suicidal behavior among LGBT youth and ultimately develop interventions. Individuals and agencies who address risk and protective factors can be lowering the likelihood of suicidal behavior in LGBT youth, even if they don't explicitly call it suicide prevention. But by making suicide prevention explicit, you can increase your effectiveness. Your problem description, the first step, will review data about contributing risk and protective factors. You can use national and local data. You will use the risk and protective factors throughout this process, especially at steps 2 and 3. To many of you, this process will be familiar as the one you use to write grant applications for funding. Next slide. Dr. Nesper from University of Michigan created this diagram to depict suicide risk. It illustrates the complexity of suicide. Oversimplifying suicide as if it were caused by one event can distort understanding and is dangerous. For example, a statement like, "he killed himself because he was bullied," can make suicide seem like a normal response to getting bullied, especially to vulnerable youth. We know that most youth who get bullied do not kill themselves. Dave Reynolds will talk more about safe messaging shortly. Bullying could be considered a trigger for suicide, but we need to consider other factors, especially, for example, that about 60% of youth and young adults who die by suicide are mentally ill and/or have a substance use disorder. Victimization, including violence and bullying, is a risk factor for mental illness, substance abuse, and low self-esteem, as well as suicide ideation and attempts. This diagram with the arrows pointing both ways depicts the interactions among risk factors. We'll talk more about victimization when we talk about safe schools. Next slide. An important message of the workshop is that being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender in itself is not a risk factor for suicidal behavior. In fact, studies have factored out variables such as mood disorders and substance abuse and found that there was little difference in suicidal behavior between LGBT youth and other youth. Notice, however, that factors like stigma, discrimination, unsafe schools, all reflect broad social forces. Next slide. Now talking about some risk factors, these are important risk factors for youth suicide. They apply to youth generally, including LGBT youth. Remember that many youth with risk factors do not attempt or die by suicide. Many of these are modifiable, such as mental illness, and substance use disorder, from which youth can recover. Method availability is also modifiable. Method refers to the method a youth uses to kill himself, such as pills or firearms. Reducing access to methods which are more lethal, such as firearms, can keep youth from dying by suicide. Interventions include training caregivers to educate and support parents to remove firearms from their homes, even temporarily, while their child is at higher risk. Some factors are non-modifiable. For example, you cannot change that a youth made a suicide attempt. Previous suicide attempts are the strongest risk factors for suicide death. As we discussed earlier, you could use this risk factor to identify a group of youth at higher risk. Next slide. These are additional risk factors related to LGB youth suicide. Again, the slide says LGB and not LGBT. For transgender youth, there is not as much research, and most of the research applies to adults. However, parental rejection and victimization are risk factors for transgender youth, and transgender youth most likely share most of these factors with lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth. A couple of the factors are related to coming out, which is specific to LGBT youth. Other factors are experienced by LGBT youth with more severity or frequency than non-LGBT youth. For example, family rejection or unsafe schools are experienced more often and more severely by LGBT youth. Another example, gender conformity, is relevant for non-LGBT youth, but it is more prevalent among LGBT youth. Notice how many of these reflect a social environment that is hostile towards and stressful for LGBT youth. Next slide. Caitlin Ryan is going to talk next about family acceptance. I'm going to focus for a couple of minutes on safe schools. But a caring adult, high self-esteem, and role models are all protective for lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth. There are other protective factors for youth generally, such as connectedness, good grades, spiritual faith, meaning in life. Next slide. You've just heard about risk and protective factors specific to the LGBT youth suicidal behavior. We've seen how larger social and cultural forces, such as discrimination or victimization, play an important role as a risk factor themselves or leading to other risk factors, such as isolation or substance abuse. LGBT cultural competence is an approach to addressing these broad social forces. Some of you work for cultural competence or diversity offices, and others of you have had competence training. So many of you know that cultural competence is pervasive and comprehensive. It affects all aspects of an agency, from outreach, staffing, policy, environment, and supervision. I want to point out that a key aspect of cultural competence is including clients in program decisions. For agencies who serve youth generally, collaborating with an agency that serves LGBT youth is one way to reach and engage LGBT youth. Next slide. Let's review some data before we illustrate a modifiable risk factor on safe schools. The first study by Bontempo and Diogelli researched LGBTQ students. The Q here stands for questioning, and found not only were LGBTQ students disproportionately victimized, but victimized LGBTQ students were more likely to attempt suicide than victimized non-gay youth. This study looked at student victimization as students who were threatened with weapons or had their belongings damaged. The second study ties bullying of LGBT students to suicide ideation, suicide attempts, and self-harm. Next slide. This is a summary of the Massachusetts 2009 Youth Risk Behavior Survey data. In this survey, about 6% of students described themselves as lesbian, gay, or bisexual. Let's say a group at your local high school reviewed this data. From this data, you can hypothesize how risk factors interact. A student who feels unsafe en route to or at school skips school, which can in turn lead to isolation and poor grades, both risk factors for suicidal behavior. Next slide. You recall this slide from earlier. Let's walk through this as an example. Say a group at a local high school knew that school safety was found to be a significant protective factor against suicidal behavior, and they agreed that school safety was amenable to change. Looking at YRBS data and data from other states, they hypothesized that an unsafe school, along with bullying and victimization, contributed to LGBT suicide risk. The group identified from a list of risk and protective factors other factors that could be related: isolation, stress, gender nonconformity. Based on the data, the group defined unsafe school to include the school building, especially the bathrooms, coming to and from school, including buses and walking routes. Cyberbullying came up, and the principal said that state legislation authorized the school to respond to off-campus bullying if it had an impact in school. One parent heard from her daughter about a teacher who bullied gay students, and the group decided to review school policy and data about complaints about teachers at the next meeting. The school administrators wanted the group to review policies already in place. The youth group recommended a focus group off school property so they could talk about school safety and a potential gay-straight alliance freely. The group wanted to define the problem as high rates of suicide attempts by LGBT students, but the Youth Risk Behavior Survey self-reports were the only way of measuring suicide attempts. They agreed to talk to an evaluator from a nearby college about measuring school safety as a key protective factor for LGBT attempts. They agreed they could evaluate changes in school safety with a number of measures, including attendance records, incidents of victimization, violence, and bullying, and YRBS results. The group agreed they'd also track program measures such as new policies and procedures, staff trainings, and student awareness activities. They felt strongly that school safety could not be addressed with window dressing. In other words, a comprehensive approach such as cultural competence, addressing school programs, policies, environment, and resources would support LGB adolescents the way they hoped. Next slide. To finish, many research findings conclude that there are higher rates of suicide ideation and attempts among LGB youth, but higher death rates have not been established. Risk and protective factors are important for guiding our work and designing interventions. Cultural competence is one approach to addressing risk and protective factors that reflect broad social and cultural forces. Thanks for listening, and we have time, I think, for a few questions.
Effie, thank you so much. That was great. There are a couple of questions that have been coming in. I'd like to invite others to submit their questions about your presentation content now, and we do have a couple of minutes to take ones that come in. First off, though, someone was asking if you could just explain the terms LGBTQ and YRBS? I know we were using a number of different acronyms and just want to make sure that people are clear.
Sure. LGBT is often used to stand for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. Q is often used for questioning. Sometimes you see U for unsure as well. Using acronyms like that is shorthand, and I acknowledge even within a group called lesbian, there's really a broad range of young people, and the same with all these categories. And we don't like to pigeonhole youth into these categories, but for research, that's the best we can do, I guess. The YRBS is the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and it's done in the USA every other year. And it's a survey where students self-report along a number of risk behaviors. A number of sites, including a couple of states, I know Vermont used to, Massachusetts does, and a number of cities administer the Youth Risk Behavior Survey to lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth. So they have data that has been really rich for researchers about that population and risk behaviors.
Great, thank you. I'm seeing a couple of reminders that oftentimes Q can also be used to indicate a queer identifying status,
oh,
too.
Oh, right, sure.
In terms of identity. So there were a few more questions that came in around clarification, and there was one question that came in about whether you could provide some examples of what we mean by cultural competence when we're talking about LGBT youth.
Sure. You know, cultural competence, usually when we use that term, people are talking about language or ethnicity. But when you look at a group like LGBT youth that have been marginalized and discriminated against, there are lots of similarities with some of the minorities that we've tried to do better by with cultural competence approaches. So it means looking at a school or a setting's policies, for example, that all the staff have training about the issues that LGBT youth face so that they reach some level of understanding about those issues. It means that some of these issues are discussed regularly at staff meetings. It might mean having a program review by youth representatives to see if you're reaching this group of youth. And one of the most important activities that I think of when I think of cultural competence is involving the youth themselves. And I would say to involve all youth, and that would include LGBT youth, but you want to make sure that the LGBT youth have a voice in it so that they can comment freely about how things are going for them in the particular setting we're talking about. And
great.
There is more in toolkit about that. Sorry.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No problem.
Okay, so I did want to let you know there have been a number of other questions that have come in, but in the interest of time, I think that we should move on, and we'll come back to those at the end. So I just wanted to thank you again, Effie, for a wonderful presentation.
Oh, thank you. And
also to let people know that if you joined us a bit late, that both the PowerPoint slides and the audio will be available on SPRC's website. And at the end, I can just remind you of where you can locate those things on our website. So now I'm pleased to introduce Caitlin Ryan, who is director of the Family Acceptance Project, which is the only community research intervention education and policy initiative that works to promote family acceptance and to decrease major health and related risks for LGBT youth, including suicide, in the context of their families. Dr. Ryan has worked on LGBT health and mental health issues for 35 years, and she focuses on promoting the well-being of LGBT children and youth in families, schools, and communities. She'll discuss research that she and her team have conducted over nearly a decade that has identified specific behaviors that families and caregivers use to express acceptance and rejection of their LGBT children's identity, and then establish the relationship between these behaviors with the health and well-being in their LGBT children in young adulthood. Tiffany, if you could please unmute Dr. Ryan's line.
Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are ready to go. Thank you.
Great.
Oh,
before
you begin, actually,
yes.
Would you like us to advance your slides, or are you going to do that?
Let me see if I can do it, and if I can't, I'll eagerly ask for your help.
Sounds great. Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to say hello to everyone who's joined us. I want to thank the Suicide Prevention Resource Center for inviting me to participate in this webinar, and to thank all of you for joining us today. It's essential to critically examine and expand the frame of suicide prevention efforts for LGBT, queer, and questioning youth. There have been few resources made available to do this work over the years, and I really hope that will start to change. As Gail pointed out, I've worked on LGBT health and mental health for 35 years, and my work with the Family Acceptance Project is the most important and hopeful work I'll ever get to do. And so I look forward to sharing a little bit of this with you today. And just so you know, we do some presentations around the country that are much longer and more substantive, including a recent day-long suicide prevention session in New Jersey. I want to start by giving you the takeaway messages, so to leave you with an understanding that families and caregivers are really essential, not just for suicide prevention, but to prevent other serious health risks and to promote the well-being and positive development of LGBT youth. And that's an area that typically has really been left out since the focus has been on risk. For a variety of reasons that I'll touch on briefly, families have been left out of the services, approaches, and even recreational activities with LGBT youth, and we need to change that. That's one of the primary goals of the Family Acceptance Project, to create a paradigm shift from serving LGBT youth either alone as individuals or through peer services to serving them in the context of their families. Our research from the Family Acceptance Project shows that families have a compelling impact on their LGBT children's health and mental health. But as I said, families are missing from our basic service delivery systems for LGBT youth. As Gail mentioned, our research has established a clear relationship between specific family accepting and rejecting behaviors during adolescence with a range of health and mental health concerns for LGBT young adults. We're currently developing a research-based model of wellness prevention and care for LGBT and gender variant children and adolescents that includes suicide prevention. And it's based on the new behavioral approach that we're developing to change the future for LGBT youth. This new family approach enables us to support positive development and decrease risk by empowering. It's all about empowerment. Ethnically, socially, and religiously diverse families to decrease rejecting behaviors that our research has shown significantly affects risk and well-being for their LGBT children. We know from research on adolescents in general that connections to families and schools are protective against major health risks, but research to study dynamics, family dynamics, from the perspective of both families and LGBT youth had not been done when we started planning our study of LGBT youth and families in 2000, and obviously that's one of the reasons why we started working in this field. When I started planning the Family Acceptance Project, we planned it really as a research, education, intervention, and public policy initiative that would help diverse families support their LGBT children in a wide range of settings. One of the big challenges in providing support to LGBT young people and those who may be questioning their sexual orientation or gender identity is widespread misinformation about homosexuality and gender identity and expression in childhood and adolescence. And this ranges from what families know and understand to what providers know and understand to advocates to all of the support services that are provided for children, youth, and families. We've actually known from ongoing research since the late 1980s that on average, young people become aware of their first crush or that first special feeling for same-gender attraction at about age 10. And other research has shown that these ages are the same, whether people identify as gay or heterosexual. This is extremely important to understand, since we've seen in our research and we continue to hear in our work with diverse families that one of the most common misconceptions about homosexuality is that adolescents can't know they're gay, and many parents and adults see coming out as LGBT during adolescence as a phase. At the same time, our research has shown that discounting an adolescent's LGBT identity, telling them it's a phase or denying their identity, is experienced by adolescents as rejection and is associated with negative health outcomes, including suicidal behavior. And parents, or caregivers or providers who are confused about these issues, for adolescents or children, are even much more confused when it comes to gender identity and gender expression and really understanding what that means. It may seem surprising that no one had done a study of how families react to their LGBT children from the perspective of both families and youth, but ours was actually the first study to examine what happens in families, how they respond behaviorally to their children's emerging LGBT identity and gender expression, and what these experiences are like from the perspective of all key family members. This is important since the way that services and approaches to LGBT youth have been developed is based on perceptions of how families react, not really on prior research. And at the same time, social attitudes have been changing dramatically, certainly over the period of time I've worked in this field. And this impacts how parents and caregivers respond to adolescents who are coming out in 2000 or 2010, which is very different than what the social environment was like in 1980 or 1990. For the past 7 years, we've been doing ongoing surveys of all of the LGBT-related groups in our state. We're in California. It's a big one and very diverse. And the purpose of that was to find out to what extent these organizations are providing any activities or any services specifically for families with LGBT children and adolescents, and obviously for diverse families. So we started doing this survey for the first time last year. The last time we did it, we found only 2 activities specifically for families with LGBT children and adolescents from all the LGBT community centers, LGBT youth programs, and PFLAG chapters in California. And this situation is reflected around the country. It may seem surprising, but we've documented this extensively directly in our research with families with LGBT children, and we've seen it in the interactions we've had with LGBT youth programs and other services over a period of years. The dearth of services really becomes an issue when you start to see our findings and learn about our experiences working with diverse families with LGBT children. That is, that they can grow and learn to support their gay and transgender children once they understand the stakes. For example, the high risk of attempted suicide among LGBT youth who feel hopeless and rejected, and when they learn how to support their LGBT children, which is part, obviously, of our behavioral family approach. One of the challenges in doing family interventions and support building to prevent suicide and other critical prevention work is that families are not included in the existing service delivery frame for LGBT youth. So instead, LGBT youth are served either as individuals and not in the context of their families or through peer support services. So across disciplines and systems of care, even my discipline of being a clinical social worker, providers still don't ask adolescents about their sexual orientation or gender identity, and for a large reason that many of them don't consider this as being relevant during adolescence, or they're uncomfortable, or they don't know how to ask these very basic questions. But if they know that an adolescent is gay or transgender, they don't follow up asking about family relationships. And we've heard a range of reactions to families of LGBT youth. Providers see families as unsupportive at best and volatile, rejecting, or violent at worst. Many have actually said they see families as the problem. So the idea of engaging families doesn't seem feasible. And prior to our research, there wasn't a reason to ask LGBT youth about their family reaction, since provider interaction time is limited and providers do what they perceive as warranted and appropriate based on their basic assessment. But one of the things that's been striking to us is hearing what LGBT services in particular have to say, and that's because typically LGBT services are in the forefront of doing the cutting-edge work for LGBT populations, and one of them has been from youth programs that they don't even talk about families, that discourse or dialogue or discussion isn't part of their work because they perceive it as being painful. In conducting our research with LGBT adolescents, young adults, and families, we wanted to understand what happens in families when youth come out or are found out during adolescence. How do their parents and caregivers respond? What do they do and say? How do they adjust and adapt to their child's LGBT identity? And most importantly, how do parents and caregivers express acceptance and rejection behaviorally of their LGBT children? And then how do these accepting and rejecting behaviors affect their gay or transgender children's health and mental health as young adults? So we looked at a range of health and mental health issues: depression, suicidal behavior, substance use and abuse, HIV risk and STDs, self-esteem, social support, life satisfaction, and sense of the future. And we found that how parents and caregivers react to their LGBT children is related to their health and well-being and as adults, young adults, in very compelling ways. We have, our project has done a series of linked studies. This is some of the core research that we've actually done that's forming the basis of our interventions. We started with in-depth interview-based research of gay and transgender LGBT adolescents and their families from urban, suburban, rural, and farm worker communities in English and Spanish all across the state. These were 2 to 4 hours long with each individual adolescent and key family members to document a whole range of experiences: child development, gender identity and expression, sexual orientation, family life, social support, religion, school and peer experiences, coming out process, and actually documenting specific family reactions of ambivalence, acceptance, and rejection. These interviews actually represented thousands of pages of transcripts that we have coded, analyzed, you know, logged into our computers. And in the context of these interviews, we really identified that there were enormous missed opportunities to intervene and make a difference early in the lives of these LGBT young people and their families. In these interviews, we identified over 100 different specific ways that parents and caregivers express acceptance and rejection of their LGBT young people. These are behaviors like supporting their gender expression or telling them they're ashamed of them. We then measured each of these family accepting and rejecting behaviors in a survey of LGBT young adults who were out to at least one parent or caregiver during adolescence. And we were able to show that parents and caregivers have a compelling impact on their children's health and well-being. We took this info back to diverse families from all ethnic backgrounds to learn directly from them how it would affect their relationship with their gay or transgender child, and how it did and how it impacted the whole family, and to have them teach us how to develop educational materials, resources, and to inform our family interventions. These are actually some of the 106 accepting and rejecting behaviors that we identified and measured. As you can see, these are common behaviors across the board, accepting behaviors and rejecting behaviors that we see all the time. Now we can actually show families how each of these 106 family reactions is related to their child's health and mental health, including depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide attempts. I don't have time to show you a range of findings, but more of these behaviors are reported in our family education booklets, and those are posted on our webpage, and you can actually download them. I want to show you how some of these rejecting and accepting behaviors are related, and how rejection and acceptance are linked with specific health concerns in adulthood. So we broke our sample of young adults into three groups: those who experienced high, moderate, and low or no levels of family rejection during adolescence. And this is to help families and providers understand that the amount of rejection actually matters. So what you can see here is that LGBT young adults with high levels of family rejection during adolescence were more than three times as likely to use illegal drugs as their peers who report no or low levels of family rejection, and use of illegal drugs was cut in half with moderate levels of family rejection. This is obviously very important for intervention. We're looking here at risk for HIV infection through unprotected sexual intercourse, and we see a three times higher risk for HIV from young people in families with high levels of rejection during adolescence and substantially lower levels of risk with moderate rejection. Our findings related to HIV and suicide have particularly powerful effects on parents and family members who are actually shocked to see the relationship between rejecting behaviors that many of them think will help their child fit in, have a good life, be accepted by others, but instead, as our research shows for the first time, are now associated with life-threatening health outcomes. When we look at suicide, it's really quite shocking for families. LGBT young adults who report high levels of family rejection during adolescence are nearly 8.5 times as likely to have tried to kill themselves at least once, compared with peers from families with no or low levels of family rejection. And moderate levels of rejection have a dramatically lower attempt rate, as you can see. We also, of course, measured and looked at the impact of family acceptance, and we found that specific accepting behaviors during adolescence, like talking with your child about their LGBT identity and incorporating a discussion of LGBT issues into everyday life and welcoming their LGBT friends and partners to family events and activities, these are protective against depression, substance abuse, and suicidal behavior in LGBT young adults. Young people with high levels of family rejection had much greater self-esteem, higher levels of social support, and better general health than their peers with no or low levels of family acceptance. And we also found that low family acceptance during adolescence was associated with three times greater likelihood of suicidal thoughts and attempts among LGBT young adults. So what we've shown empirically is that what obviously so many providers who work with LGBT young people have known for years, that family reactions matter. But in an information age, it's really important to be able to show this with research. So we found that family rejection is linked with serious health and mental health problems, including suicidal thoughts and attempts, while family acceptance is a protective factor that helps promote well-being for LGBT young people. This research shows the critical importance of engaging families in the lives of their LGBT children and changing how services are delivered across disciplines, agencies, and systems of care. It also means changing how we do parent education and how we teach parents to nurture their children before they ever know who they will become. So we're trying to get these findings out as quickly as possible in a wide range of tools and resources for use in multiple settings. We're publishing research papers in peer-reviewed journals across disciplines, since many providers only read in their discipline or practice area, and this obviously is providing an empirical foundation for our work. We have a lot more to publish if we can keep the funding going. We've developed basic family education materials. Our work is done in three large language groups, English, Spanish, and Chinese, to be used across the U.S. and other countries. We're just getting some resources now to write our family education booklets at two lower literacy levels, and I'm trying to get some funding to produce them for families from specific faith and religious backgrounds. We've also been working to raise funds to develop a series of very short, very powerful documentaries that show the journey of ethnically and religiously diverse families from struggle to support of their LGBT children. These are really important resources, since these tell the stories that don't get told, these stories of transformation and hope. They're based on our research. They're designed to give LGBT youth and families hope, provide role models of families that ethnically diverse families don't ever get to see, and help them understand that there that is a process, that many people think, well, I can never possibly support this. I don't really even know what to do. But these videos actually depict the journeys. We've been developing policy guidelines, assessment tools, including a rapid risk assessment tool that's based on our research and quickly helps providers identify gay and transgender youth at risk for family rejection and related health risks, including depression, suicide, substance abuse, and STDs. We're developing these family intervention strategies to be used in very diverse settings, primary care, mental health, schools, family service agencies, child welfare and juvenile justice, and other settings in those three language groups. And we will ultimately develop training materials and training opportunities to teach providers how to use these family interventions with diverse families when we're ready at that stage of the process. Part of what we're also doing are community engagement strategies to help communities understand that we have to approach families as allies, not enemies. We've been working, obviously, with groups here in California, but also in Massachusetts, Utah, and Michigan, and beginning to plan some work in Colorado. And we have been spearheading an international movement of family acceptance. So we've worked outside the U.S. in Mexico, Spain, Latin America, and China. And what's so exciting to us is to see that the behaviors we've studied and measured here are reflected in families around the world, including the phenomenon of family acceptance. As families become more accepting and supportive, they become more open, they discuss these issues, and the behaviors that we've identified and measured are reflected. Really quickly, here is an example of one of our basic family education booklets. These are online. You can download them. We have a little evaluation process because we continually work to improve our products and the materials we're developing. As I mentioned, we're trying to raise funds to complete a series of short documentaries that help show ethnically and religiously diverse families how to support their LGBT children. One of these videos is on our webpage. I'm writing a discussion guide for it, and we will start to disseminate it later this year. This is us in the alley next to our office. We post our materials and resources online as soon as we can get them completed. I guess the main message I want to give is that our experiences are so hopeful in working with these very diverse families from all kinds of backgrounds and their LGBT children, and hope is critical for changing the future for LGBT youth and their families. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this, and I look forward to answering questions later in the session. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Caitlin. That was wonderful. There have been a number of questions that have been coming in for you specifically, and I think we have time for a couple of those, and then some I'm going to save towards the end, and I want to let everyone know who has been submitting questions that we're doing our best to get to them, and so hopefully we will be able to address your questions by the end. One question that came in had to do with whether or not there was research that shows acceptance behaviors in families that are LGBT themselves, I would imagine the parents or guardians, or other relatives who have identified as LGBT as being any different from heterosexually identified families. And if so, is there something to be learned from these families?
No one has actually done this research with heterosexual families. So we're the only ones who've done it behaviorally. And included, obviously, in our research are LGBT parents and parents who have had same-gender experiences and never talked about it, but it was part of their history and lives. So we do have information about what happens in those families. We haven't really seen significant differences between LGBT parents and parents in general, other than some, obviously, LGBT parents are much more informed and know what to expect and therefore can be there to help their gay or transgender children, but that's not always the case.
Okay, great. There are a couple of other questions, too. One has to do with whether or not there's any one family member who has been shown to have a more powerful impact than another family member in terms of their acceptance and rejection. And then there's a second part to the question about, is a family of mixed acceptance and rejection counted as a high, moderate, or low rejection family?
Well, first of all, to answer that second part first, they weren't counted as high, moderate, or low if they were mixed. The high, moderate, or low came from the number of accepting and rejecting behaviors that each LGBT young adult reported occurring in their families during adolescence. So these are specific behaviors related to family acceptance and rejection. For example, did your parent or caregiver beat, kick, hit, punch you because of your LGBT identity? Or did your parent or caregiver find a positive role model for you as an LGBT young person? So those are the behaviors that we measured, and then we quantified them by the number, the dose, if you will, of those experiences. I'm afraid I forgot the first part of the question. Could you remind me?
Sure. I'm just scrolling to track it down. Hang on one second.
Oh, I think maybe it was if there were parents of different, you know, a rejecting parent and an accepting parent.
Yes,
or an
thank you.
Parent. Oh, okay. Well, we know from research in general that having a supportive adult makes a huge difference. So since we did a Rashomon-like approach to that famous film of looking at an experience from the perspective of different people involved in it, so the, you know, individually with the adolescent themselves, at least one parent or caregiver, typically a grandparent, aunt or uncle, older sibling, who really knew the process and family experience of that LGBT young person, we were able to get a cluster of people involved with their lives. And in families with mixed reactions, a supportive family member does make a difference. And typically that young person will feel more connected to that supportive family member, and they're giving them something that they're not getting. So if viewers have an opportunity, for example, to, after the webinar or some other time, go to our webpage and look at the family video story that's up there, it's only 15 minutes. But they'll see an example of this, a Mexican-American family. The dad is very traditional, very self-described macho. The son is gender variant. And the mom is more supportive of, you know, this little toddler playing with dolls. The dad is horrified. And so it actually tells the story of the journey of that family. What's great about this and what we actually saw in real life is that rejecting families can become more supportive, and now we know that with the early intervention of the kind of interventions we're developing, we can make a difference a lot sooner. And in fact, our work is designed to work in early childhood and, you know, with new parents. And of course, all of this we learned from the families that we worked with, you know, over this long period of time.
Great. And one last quick question before we move on to Dave's presentation has to do with whether or not there's been research on LGBTQ teens who are in foster care or state care and the families that they're placed with in regards to family acceptance.
Yes, we included out-of-home youth, including homeless youth, youth who've been thrown out of their homes, youth who were removed and placed in custodial care, foster care, and juvenile justice. So we do have data on those young people and their families. And again, the reality of the lived experience is so much richer and more fascinating and so much more powerful than the perceptions that people have, which are very impoverished. We've seen some extraordinary stories of, you know, families whose kids are removed for different reasons and they struggle to get them back. The stories are much more hopeful than I think we would understand. And by really working with families to help them understand that behaviors they thought were going to help their child have a good life, like trying to change their LGBT identity or punish them or isolate them from the family because of who they are, that these behaviors have a serious negative impact on their health and well-being, including suicide attempts. And I can tell you, sitting with families who are seeing these findings for the first time, and we use pictures in different languages, they're often in tears when they realize that their child who's been, you know, withdrawn and sad or maybe even attempted suicide, that there are consequences to their behavior. So I think the future is very positive for using families as a critical ally and partner in suicide prevention for LGBT children and adolescents.
Okay, thank you so much again. Finally, I'd like to introduce Dave Reynolds, who is Senior Public Policy and Research Manager at the Trevor Project, a national organization focused on crisis and suicide prevention efforts among lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth. He'll describe evidence-based practices related to media coverage of suicides and public health campaigns to prevent suicide. Using specific examples related to LGBTQ youth, he will explain how members of the media, suicide prevention professionals, and advocates can follow safe and effective messaging standards when communicating about suicide prevention and the LGBTQ community. Dave, I understand that your line has already been unmuted.
That's what the voice told me.
Excellent. The floor is yours.
Well, good afternoon, colleagues in the continental United States, and good morning to folks in Hawaii, Alaska, and Guam. It is a real privilege to be presenting alongside Effie and Caitlin, both of whom are really wonderful thinkers in the field of youth suicide prevention, specifically LGBT youth suicide prevention. I'd also like to thank the Suicide Prevention Resource Center for putting together what to me is a very important research to practice series. And so with that in mind, I will jump in to talking about effective messaging that is safe, that's encouraged by a lot of leaders in the community, and that is won't lead to a heightened risk for suicide for those folks ingesting the messages, if you will. In our next about 20 minutes or so, I'm going to review the mission and the services from the Trevor Project, offer some recommendations for the media, some recommendations for professionals and advocates like yourselves who may be engaged in LGBTQ youth suicide prevention or in general youth suicide prevention, and then talk some about social media, the use of Facebook, the use of Twitter, and how that's changed how we communicate issues around suicide prevention. And the overall focus is just, again, best practices for communication about LGBTQ youth suicide. So with that in mind, I'd like to talk with you some. As was told, the Trevor Project is the leading national organization focused on suicide and crisis prevention efforts amongst lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth. The operational definition of transgender that we utilize is someone whose gender identity or internal sense of how they view their gender does not match that biological sex, male or female, that they were assigned at birth. And we also make sure that our resources are available to questioning youth. Because a lot of times when adolescents are questioning their sexual orientation and or gender identity, so much of that shame and stigma that's already been referenced, actually they go through that too, because there's a lot of shame in even questioning one's sexual orientation. Like with Effie and Caitlin, you'll see me tailor the LGBTQ acronym accordingly to reflect the research accurately and where it exists and where it does not exist. So, the services of the Trevor Project include our flagship program, the Trevor Lifeline, which is the nation's only 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week crisis and suicide prevention lifeline for LGBTQ youth. Not all calls to our lifeline are acutely suicidal based on our standard risk assessment, so in many ways it does operate as a warm line as well. We are accredited by the American Association of Suicidology and received the Crisis Call Center Excellence Award for our innovative techniques in suicide prevention with a particularly hard-to-find and oftentimes referred to as invisible group at the AAS conference in April 2010, last year in Florida. We hope you'll attend again this year in Portland. We'll be leading a day-long institute. It's also important when you spell out the Trevor Lifeline number that you now also put it out in numbers, not just 1-866 for you, Trevor, but that you communicate spelled out in digits. And the reason is why is a lot of today's phones no longer put the letters on the keys, and we want to make sure that youth are readily available to access any type of crisis intervention service. So you'll also see 1-800-273-TALK beginning to move in that direction and spell it out completely in numbers. I don't know if spelling in numbers is the correct way you would say that, but nonetheless. we launched Trevor Chat recently, which is a free confidential online messaging service that provides live help with non-suicide related crises through the Trevor Project's website. After watching several different agencies launch instant messaging services to speak with youth and adults, we decided that this was a great way to tap into an ever increasingly tech savvy generation of young people, and many of whom may not be comfortable utilizing a traditional crisis intervention resource like a Lifeline. We also offer TrevorSpace.org, which is a social networking site for LGBTQ youth and their straight allies, which is designed to create a sense of community. One of the most common things we hear from young people on the Trevor Lifeline through Dear Trevor on Trevor Chat is, "I'm alone. I'm the only gay person in Tallahassee. I'm the only transgender person in Spokane." And we know that that's not true. However, it can still feel so isolating to be that person. And so we created a site similar to Facebook or MySpace where young people can create profiles, upload pictures, videos, connect with young people. We infuse a lot of positive public health programming in there, as well as a lot of the available resources, not just related to suicide, but to a variety of issues that young people face, particularly young LGBTQ people. And with over 14,000 members in just a year and a half, we found that it's been a wonderful instrument in our suicide prevention work. We also launched Dear Trevor, which is a non-time-sensitive question and answer forum for a host of issues that could be the precipitating crises that could contribute to suicide risk. So perhaps talking about coming out to parents, dealing with or trying to reconcile a religious or faith base with a developing sexual orientation and gender identity, issues on deliberate self-harm, issues on nutrition. We really get a whole variety of questions. And I invite you to visit our website, thetrevorproject.org, and actually see some examples of those questions and our responses to the young people who have written in to us. We also understand that there, as we've seen, there is a big contributing factor of the environments that young LGBTQ people are engaging in, are part of every day, their schools, their homes, and their communities. And if we don't begin to address some of these issues that are occurring in these communities, we are frankly not going to see the volume go down on the Trevor Lifeline, the demand for our other crisis intervention services decrease. And so we've created the Lifeguard Workshops, which are age-appropriate curricula to be used in classrooms. Right now, currently, they're available in the state of California, the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut tri-state area, soon to be Washington, D.C., and we're continuing to grow that program. In the areas where we don't yet have our facilitators who are trained to go into schools to talk about suicide, sexual orientation, gender identity, we have our free survival kits, which are educational kits distributed nationwide to educators, youth service providers, youth leaders who want to conduct their own lifeguard workshops. And you can order those for free through our website by clicking on the Educator Resources tab. So now into the meat of what I'm here to talk about today, which is safe, effective, and encouraged messaging when we're talking about LGBTQ youth suicide. You see here that I'm highlighting the dangers of what we call sensational stories, stories that the media may purposefully or non-purposefully, the way they report on something can actually contribute significantly to suicide risks. So even if you're not a member of the media yourself and looking through the registration, I know we don't have a whole lot of folks from the media, you will likely speak with local members of the media, affiliates, and other groups in your area. And as the resident experts in your community, you should be able to help the media report responsibly on suicide risk amongst LGBTQ youth. And so suicide attempt rates increased when the number of stories about suicide increases in press, online, television, news. A particular death is reported at length in many outlets, such as an opening piece, the opening segment on 60 Minutes, the front page of the New York Times, or even the opening story on your local 11 o'clock news and the front page of your local town newspaper. Headlines about specific deaths, so the death of a young person, I'll use a name that we're all probably very familiar with, Tyler Clementi. Headlines about specific deaths are framed dramatically and or provide a great amount of detail including photos of the person, descriptions of the location, the means that they used in their suicide attempt. All of that really detailed information can actually increase the risk for suicide in all youth who are digesting these messages. An example, and finally, stories that portray a suicide victim as a martyr. So an example of irresponsible reporting would be a headline like, "Boy, 10, hangs himself over poor grades." That would be irresponsible reporting.
Dave, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I've seen a couple of comments that people are having trouble hearing you. I'm not sure where the problem might be, but if you could speak up a little bit, that would be great.
Is this better?
It definitely sounds better on my end.
Good, good.
Thank you
for the heads up. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Sorry about that. Okay. Recommendations for the media. There's some really important things that the media can do and that you can encourage members of the media that you interact with. And they can help prevent suicide by first telling the warning signs of suicide. Many folks on this phone call are very well acquainted with what the warning signs of suicide are, or those things and patterns we would notice about someone that we were concerned about who might make a suicide attempt. However, largely, they're still not really known by a lot of communities. And so we recommend using the American Association of Suicidology's Warning Signs of Suicide, which is available from the Suicide Prevention Resource Center's Best Practices Registry, and I provided a little link at the bottom that will encourage you. But basically, we ask that you call 911 or seek immediate help from a mental health provider when you hear or see any of these behaviors: someone threatening to hurt or kill themselves, someone looking for a way to kill themselves, seeking access to pills, weapons, or other means of suicide, someone talking about or writing about death, dying, or suicide. And we suggest that people seek help by contacting a mental health professional or calling 1-800-273-TALK or the Trevor Lifeline or another type of crisis intervention line for a referral should you witness, hear, see anyone exhibiting any of the following behaviors: hopelessness, rage, anger, seeking revenge, acting reckless, or engaging in risky activities seamlessly without thinking, feeling trapped, like there's nowhere else, like there's no way out, increased drug or alcohol use, withdrawing from friends, families, community, society, anxiety, agitation, the inability to sleep or sleeping all the time. So really we're looking at big changes in either direction in eating and sleeping patterns, dramatic mood changes, and just no reason for living. They seem purposelessness. They see no sense or purpose in life. And again, that information is available on the link at the bottom of the page. Encouraging help-seeking behavior. Research has shown that youth themselves are not help-seeking. Most of the time they feel that they can deal with a problem on their own, that their problem is not important enough to reach out for help. So we want to encourage them to use confidential, non-judgmental resources, again, like 1-800-273-TALK, the Trevor Lifeline, or really any of the resources that you've had good experience with. It's important to communicate effective treatments. There are effective treatments for mental illness, like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. There is hope to get help for these issues. It's important to offer resources to make sure that young people know there are places that they can go for help. And finally, the media needs to acknowledge what we call complex causes of suicide. And we're going to get into that, but the big point is to not oversimplify. We don't want to oversimplify the cause of suicide down into a soundbite that, in fact, could be erroneous and potentially dangerous. Let's see. Okay. So what is a complex cause? A complex cause is messaging around suicide prevention should acknowledge the underlying causes of suicide often include individual factors like depression and anxiety and cannot be attributed to experiences like bullying alone. It's always more than just a recent event.
As you heard Effie and Caitlin talk about, sexual orientation and gender identity alone are not risk factors for suicide. Just because someone is gay or lesbian or transgender does not inherently put them at a higher risk for suicide. You also heard Effie talk about there is no causal, empirically validated link between being the victim of bullying and making a suicide attempt. More likely, bullying is exacerbated by other pre-existing issues, and it's better described as a contributing factor or a precipitating event related to suicide, and not the cause of suicide. I'm going to briefly highlight some problematic coverage around suicide, two stories perhaps that you may be familiar with. The first is the People cover with Phoebe Prince, a young Irish immigrant in western Massachusetts who completed suicide after enduring relentless bullying as well as some other issues going on in her life. We want to avoid phrases like bullied to death and bully side. They're problematic because they conflate the cause of death with a precipitating event like bullying. And they also feed the unverified link between bullying and suicide. Also, when you sit down and you think about it, the term bully side is inaccurate and confusing and simply bad messaging. Just as patricide refers to murdering one's father, bully side suggests the murder of a bully, not a suicide death. But even apart from that confusion, again, claiming that an individual's suicide death was caused by bullying is dangerous and can elevate the risk of people who see these stories attempting suicide. Highlight some better media coverage for you, and I really like to encourage you to visit the links at the bottom of this page to find out more about better media coverage. The first, I'm not just impartial because it covers the Trevor Project, and I interviewed for it. It's actually a really great article because it was one of the first media outlets that we were able to work on with some of these updated messaging that we'll be continuing to share throughout the call today. The hotline serves the 24/7 lifeline for struggling gay youths. It avoids sensationalistic headlines and makes available resources known throughout. Gay teens told it gets better, right? These are not talking about bully side or Seth, 13, kills himself because of bullying. These are much more resource-affirming and provide the type of information we're really looking for those who ingest these media messages to take home with them. Here's another great one. I highlighted one where ABC News didn't do such a great job, but I feel like it's important to highlight one where ABC News did do a good job. Again, highlighting available resources, support, counseling. We talked about encouraging help-seeking and that there are effective treatments. This is some of the most important information we can convey to young people. For more information on how the media can report on suicide, I direct you to our partners at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and they're reporting on suicide recommendations for the media, which is available from their site. So now talking about some messaging to avoid. This is really for professionals and advocates involved in LGBTQ youth suicide prevention. Again, we want to avoid detailed descriptions of a specific suicide or the means used in that suicide. We don't want to talk about personal details of those who died by suicide. It's important to remember that any suicide victim leaves behind a family and friends and whatever communities they were a part of, and that those communities need time to process as well. If you're an LGBT local organization, memorializing a suicide victim in a press release is actually something we would avoid doing. Using the term epidemic, the overall prevalence of bullying in the United States has gone down over the last 10 years. The media attention has continued to talk about the issue and shed light on it, but again, avoid using the term epidemic. My theme for today, which is to avoiding oversimplifying bullying, it's not black and white. And finally, presenting suicide as a common event or logical consequence is bullying. We don't want to lead young people to believe that suicide is a common and normal response to difficult life events, like bullying, right? We don't want to add stigma to an already stigmatized issue, but we don't want to normalize it. That can be very dangerous. And I also want to pause here because I actually see a lot of my colleagues on the attendance list today. and say that we've all made mistakes over the past few months. We've all made mistakes in how we've talked about this in public forums, press releases, news releases, on social media, and that the recommendations we're sharing with you and our partners who helped draft these recommendations as well, who will be acknowledged later, it's important to learn from these mistakes that we made in the fall of 2010 when there was a heightened focus on LGBTQ youth suicide, and learn from them and use what we know from the research regarding responsible media coverage and move forward from there. And just always keep in mind that the people we are trying to protect, the families of suicide victims, are struggling, and we need to be careful about how we talk about their loved ones. Again, we don't want to assume or guess the sexual orientation or the gender identity of a victim. I'm aware of several instances this fall where people would contact us asking how many gay suicides have happened, was this person gay, was this person a lesbian, and it's really important that we don't guess or assume. We also want to, again, avoid conflating a precipitating event like bullying with the cause of suicide. I believe my colleague Effie used the term distorting. I really like that. Ignoring mental illness as a likely cause. Research has found that mental illness and mental health struggles were documented in most completed suicides among youth in the U.S., so it's important not to point at one event or cause, but rather remember that, as I've said, it's more complex. Again, avoiding glorifying suicide, making celebrities of victims, or portraying victims as martyrs. And for those folks specifically in the LGBT movement, it's really important not to link LGBTQ youth suicide with political issues or larger public policy issues like gay marriage, don't ask, don't tell, employment non-discrimination. These are all separate political issues that frankly don't have any proven direct link with suicide attempt in LGBTQ youth. And so saying something like Tyler Clementi wouldn't have killed himself if we had employment non-discrimination laws in place is not only erroneous, but it's also dangerous. It doesn't benefit LGBTQ youth or adults or frankly, the mission and views of the larger LGBTQ movement, as diverse as those views oftentimes are. So again, looking towards recommended messaging with youth, encouraging help-seeking behavior and making available resources known as much as possible. We want to emphasize individual and collective responsibility for supporting the LGBTQ youth, the well-being of LGBTQ people. Perhaps if you wanted to talk about the issue, you could say, quote, Stephen's death is an important reminder that individuals, families, communities, and the whole of society have a responsibility to support the well-being of LGBT people. So again, focusing on individual and collective responsibility. And finally, focusing on positive terms like psychological well-being, and that psychological well-being of LGBTQ youth can be compromised by various factors and stressors. So something you could say that would be good recommended messaging would be that persistent bullying can contribute to feelings of depression and anxiety, among others, and that this can increase suicide risk. Wrapping up briefly, continue recommended messaging. Talk about the importance of family acceptance. There are about 675 folks on this phone call, and I hope that everyone here visits the website for the Family Acceptance Project today. It is a truly wonderful organization that does just great work. Talk about systematically addressing bullying. So what do we mean by systematically addressing bullying? Using Stephen as our example again, we might say, the fact that Stephen appears to have suffered persistent bullying should be a wake-up call to families, school communities, and policymakers alike. Research indicates that bullying of this kind can lead to depression, anxiety, and other problems that can increase suicide risk. And always connect bullying and the need for prevention back to the health, safety, and general well-being of LGBTQ people. I want to briefly introduce you all to a campaign that we like. I call it an exemplary campaign, and it's from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA. It's called What a Difference a Friend Makes. And what we like about it is it encourages help seeking. It doesn't normalize suicide while at the same time not adding further stigma to the issue. It views mental health in a comprehensive part of overall health. It offers resources, and there's easily and it's available to a wide variety of audiences. It does not dramatize or sensationalize, and it's also engaging to youth, right? You could have the best content in the world, the best evidence-based content in an online intervention or an online resource or an online site, but if it's not engaging to youth, they're not going to take the information home with them. Talking some about social media briefly, using Twitter or Facebook to announce a suicide death is actually something we would, again, recommend not to do. Again, there are many organizations on the phone who may have done that, ourselves included. This is learning from those experiences. Giving detailed descriptions of a suicide death or victim and posting photos of a suicide victim. It's important to notice that there's a difference between families and friends and other individuals who are close to a suicide victim posting images and an organization that may not even be familiar with that person before they died, appropriating that image for its own institutional posts. Creating virtual memorials or tributes for a suicide victim, again, leaving that to families and people directly connected to the person and not doing that yourself. Reposting problematic mainstream media headlines. So if you see one of those problematic ones, like student 15 commits suicide over bullying, don't repost problematic mainstream headlines. In fact, if you can in your post, change the headline. Use it as an opportunity to, educate your colleagues and friends. Again, avoiding referring to suicide epidemics, and thinking again, be careful. Instead of suicide epidemic, you could say several recent reports of suicide attempts. And finally, remembering that when someone wants to support your Facebook status or your Facebook post, they click like. Think about student 15 commits suicide over bullying, 16 people like this. It's not a great way to get the message out there. So just remembering how you phrase things when you put them on Facebook. And finally, I've listed another great resource for you from the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's Responding to Online Users in Crisis. And it helps you work with social networking sites. And if the user is known to you and you're worried about someone you see on Facebook or MySpace that you're concerned about, we want you to reach out to folks at either 273-TALK, the Trevor Lifeline, local service providers, law enforcement officials, or 911. If you're worried about someone that you don't know, you can report your concerns to write directly to the individual sites, and on that resource I mentioned are the actual contacts at those individual sites, because you think about Tyler Clementi's Facebook status, and if someone had taken the time to reach out to him and just speak to him or had reported to Facebook, there's a chance that we could have prevented that crisis. I'd like to acknowledge our partners, some of whom are on the phone today, who put recommendations and evidence forth for what I've talked about, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, GLSEN, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, also known as GLAAD, our wonderful funders at the Johnson Family Foundation and the Movement Advancement Project, and of course the Trevor Project was there as well. I know we'll have time for some specific questions for me immediately following my section and also in a more general open period at the end, but if you would like to get in contact with me directly, I've provided my contact information here so that you can email or call me directly and we can support you and your work wherever you are to the best of our ability. So thank you very much for your time today.
Dave, thank you so much. I'm aware of the time and the fact that that we need to wrap up this web event. So I do want to thank you, and I want to thank Effie Malley and Caitlin Ryan for your presentations, and let you know that although we didn't get to all of the questions and we did run out of time, a number of the questions that came in were answered during your presentations. So thank you for that. And to anyone who did submit a question that did not get answered, we apologize for that. And the contact information for all three presenters are included in their slides, which are up on our website. And so you can feel free to contact them directly or contact us at SPRC, and we would be happy to connect you with resources and any additional information that you are seeking. So again, I'd like to thank you so much for participating in our webinar today. As you know from the numbers of people that we had and also from my end, the questions that were coming in, this is quite a popular topic right now, and we look forward to continuing the conversations with you. So thank you again and take care.